for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The UN and nations around the world condemn the Bush-era interrogation practices that were detailed in a long-awaited Senate report. A teenage suicide bomber attacks a French school in Afghanistan, and police in Hong Kong break up protest camps and arrest more than 200 pro-democracy activists. Joining me for the week's top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, Mark Landler of The New York Times, Kim Katas of the BBC, and Michael Crowley of Politico. I look forward to hearing your questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And welcome to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
Good to see you. And Mark Landler, what has the international reaction been to the release of this report on enhanced interrogation?
Well, Diane, I mean, one thing it's done is given a lot of countries that have their own issues with mistreatment and human rights abuses a convenient excuse to take the moral high ground against the United States. So you've seen a bunch of statements of outrage from the Chinese, the Russians, the Supreme Leader of Iran, the North Koreans. There are also some expressions of deep concern from places like the United Nations, where the special rapporteur on torture said he believed that U.S. officials should be prosecuted for these interrogation techniques. And he said that he travels to parts of the world where people can't understand why these officials aren't being held accountable. Among our allies, there's some more awkward situations. The British, for example, initially said that they had only asked the United States or the Senate Select Committee to redact parts of the report that raised national security concerns for Britain. Similar to what the administration did here in the U.S. It turns out, though, that there were a broader set of redactions requested by the Brits having to do with intelligence activities that they've been involved with the United States. And this has reopened, you know, a long simmering question in Britain about to what extent the Brits were complicit with the United States. There are some cases of people who were transferred to Libya and subjected to torture by the Libyan regime. Mm-hmm. And people in Britain have long called for investigations of this. And so this issue, as it has in the United States, has been reopened by the publication of the torture report.
Yeah, I think the reaction has been interesting, because to some extent we all knew that these enhanced interrogation techniques were being used both in the U.S. and abroad. It's the level of detail that has reawakened the sort of shock at what was taking place during those years up until President Obama issued an executive order to ban the use of those techniques. And there are different, as Mark was pointing out, there are different reactions around the world. You have those countries like Iran, like North Korea, that say, well, you know, why does the U.S. take the moral high ground? You have allies who are being put in an uncomfortable position. You also have allies like the Germans who say that, you know, in a commentary in a German daily, for example, Obama's admission of guilt is a sign of national greatness. That is goes exactly to the point that the president himself was making. Yes, we made mistakes. Yes, we have shortcomings. But the democracy works. The system works because at some point we come out, we look back, we try to learn from our mistakes in the hope that it doesn't happen again. I think the question that people will have is, will that really be enough? Because there have been warnings in the past from the CIA that torture programs don't work. It was an assessment by the CIA at the end of the 80s, and yet they felt compelled to try it again. And it is, you know, to use this infamous quote or famous quote, insanity is doing the same thing again and again and hoping it produces different results. So what will the U.S. do the next time there is something similar to the 9/11 attacks? God forbid it should happen.
Here is what Vice President Cheney had to say.
from our perspective, if you were sitting in my chair, the president's chair, our job is to keep the country safe and secure and go get those guys who hit us on 9/11. And that's exactly what we did. We did what we felt was necessary. The professionals in the intelligence community, especially at the CIA, did one hell of a job, and they deserve our gratitude.
He called the report, Michael Crowley, he called it a terrible piece of work. He said it was deeply flawed. I wonder how much you believe the international reaction is going to shape the discussion going forward, or is it going to be the politics in this country?
Diane, as a general rule, I think that the American political system is not that responsive to international opinion unless it's really involves a dire threat to the country. So for the moment, it doesn't seem to me to be a crucial component. And what's interesting to some degree here is the dog that is not barking in that regard, which is to say that in the run-up to the release of this report, we had several days of really, if you turned on your television a few days ago, it was round-the-clock, TikTok countdown, embassy security stepped up, worldwide warnings to American personnel. You would have thought we were going to have a dozen Benghazis on Tuesday night. And it's actually been pretty quiet on that front. In fact, I'm not aware of a major event in that regard. So I think unless and until we have that sort of a consequence, that the international reaction will be secondary to the American political debate. If there is some kind of a significant, heaven forbid, attack on an American installation, diplomats, tourists overseas, then you will see this very intense, very emotional argument about who is culpable for this. I'm sure Republicans will seek to blame the Democrats and the Senate Intelligence Committee. Let's cross our fingers it doesn't come to that. But, Diane, my answer would be that that's probably the way in which we would have a real international dimension to this conversation.
I've been so interested to learn that the polling among Americans has changed on the use of these enhanced interrogation techniques with the beheadings that we've seen by members of ISIL. I do want to mention that London's airspace mm-hmm. has been closed, apparently due to a computer failure and no full understanding of why this has happened. But boy, at Christmas time, really changes things.
The polls have changed, perhaps, in the wake of those beheadings by the Islamic State. But I think that is precisely why people need to take a step back and ask themselves exactly what these enhanced interrogation techniques, as they're called in such a euphemism, actually achieve. Because there have been many moments in history, including in this country, where people thought they were doing the right thing to protect the nation. And looking back, they thought, you know what, that actually did not achieve the right results.
And could have made things worse.
Yes. And could have made things worse. Back to the days of, you know, World War II and when the Japanese were interned in camps. So there are always moments where people think they're doing the right thing. And then when you look back, you realize it wasn't. So I think that that was also the purpose of this exercise, to have a document that people can hold up and say, remember what we found. But of course, you know, the politics mean that not everybody agrees with this document.
I wanted to pick up on something that Michael said earlier when he was talking about why we haven't seen violent reaction overseas. Because even before the report came out, there were people in the administration that said that their sort of sense and analysis of the things that cause people to attack consulates and embassies overseas are usually motivated by denigration of Islam, burning of Qurans, satirical videos about the Prophet Muhammad. I mean, if you look at the Benghazi attack, and I know that's a very murky situation, what actually precipitated it, but the fact is these violent uprisings are almost always linked to something that's very religious. and viewed as a desecration of Islam. What's interesting about at least the 500 pages of this report that have been released is that for all the horrifying treatment, the shackling of people to cold floors, the wall hitting, the, you know, the waterboarding, Islam actually doesn't come in for much denigration by the CIA interrogators. Now, that's actually in some contrast to the Abu Ghraib situation, where there was actual desecration and disrespecting of the Quran, and it did in fact lead to reprisals against Americans in Iraq. It remains to be seen, of course, whether more will come out. Yeah. It's a 6,000-page right. report, and so there may be further disclosures. One of the things that American officials were worried about, it feels to me this has already happened, but they were worried that the narrative of Guantanamo Bay, the orange jumpsuits, the waterboarding, the rituals of CIA interrogation have already been picked up and exploited by ISIS, by al-Qaeda. They now parade their hostages in jumpsuits that are meant to echo the jumpsuits worn in Guantanamo Bay. And there's allegations that the hostages in Syria were waterboarded.
Mark Plandler, he is White House correspondent in the New York Times. Short break, right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from World Vision, a Christian organization dedicated to serving the most vulnerable children, working in nearly 100 countries to provide fullness of life by tackling the root causes of poverty and injustice. Learn more at worldvision.org. From Staples, offering in-store shipping for personal and business packages, open 7 days a week with extended store hours and shipping supplies. Staples, make more happen. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
And welcome back to the International Hour of our Friday News Roundup this week with Michael Crowley of Politico, Kim Katas of the BBC, and Mark Landler of the New York Times. Just before the break, we were rounding up our conversation on the torture report, but I know you want to add something, Michael.
Well, Mark was making several interesting points about what we have historically seen will cause a violent reaction against Americans overseas. You mentioned desecrations of Islam. People may remember that Newsweek had a report of Qurans being flushed down the toilet maybe 8 to 10 years ago, which precipitated quite a lot of violence in Afghanistan. So that's a reminder. The other point I would make is images are extremely powerful in a way that I think a 500-page document, even with gruesome, horrifying passages, may not break through to the public consciousness the way those images of Abu Ghraib did. And so we've seen the administration actually suppress the release of some further images, and I think that images are more explosive than words.
Kim.
Yes, and also, again, picking up on what Mark was saying, for those who resent the U.S. around the world, details of interrogation techniques such as these I think, cause a shrug of the shoulder. Well, you see, we told you the United States is terrible and this is what it does to people. It holds. And then you have people who live in countries where torture is also used, for example, Syria, who shrug and say, this is what you call torture. You should come and see what our government does to us. Mm.
Terrible thought. Terrible thought. All right, let's talk about Afghanistan, the formal end of U.S. combat operations. What is the future for U.S. engagement there, Michael?
Well, Diane, there are two questions here. One is, what is the stated future of U.S. engagement, and what will the future actually be for U.S. engagement? And we are already starting to see the plans that President Obama made for America's exit from Afghanistan beginning to change. President has recently sort of expanded the terms under which American forces can conduct combat operations next year. The formal ISAF combat mission has ended this month in Afghanistan, and the Afghans are now taking the formal lead, taking the fight out into the field against the Taliban. The U.S. was going to essentially stop combat operations that did not involve targeting al-Qaeda and would not provide air support to the Afghans. The president has changed that position. We will now be supporting the Afghans in some engagements against the Taliban, and we will also be American forces will be authorized to conduct their own operations directly against the Taliban if necessary in particularly high threat situations. The plan now is to have about 10,000 American troops in Afghanistan next year. We'll go down to about 5,000 the year after, and the plan is, by the end of 2016, we'll basically zero out. But I will leave you with this concluding thought, which is Iraq is very much on everyone's mind. And that's why I think the plans are already beginning to change. And I think they are going to be discussing much more whether they need to change them further to prevent a repeat of Iraq.
I mean, the other big question longer term is the financial and economic involvement of the U.S. And one thing that was relevant in this regard that came out recently was a new report by the Special Inspector General for Reconstruction in Afghanistan, a gentleman who's been looking into this for years in some obscurity because so much of the focus is on the military engagement. He recently issued a report where he laid out the seven major threats to the United States' efforts to rebuild Afghanistan. I mean, it's estimated that the U.S. has squandered already upwards of $100 billion on reconstruction in Afghanistan. And he sees many of the same issues, rampant corruption, sustainability. We pour lots of money into building bridges and dams. How long will those be maintained? The state of the Afghan security forces, this is very similar to what Michael was saying about Iraq. If we don't train a viable fighting force, not only to take on the Taliban, but to secure the country, a lot of the money we pour in will go to waste. And then finally, the drug trade, which is a sort of a perennial problem in Afghanistan and shows signs of blooming once again. So there's a whole range of longer-term issues around corruption and management that the United States will have to confront in the coming years, even once the immediate military challenges are dealt with.
And so even as the U.S. ends its engagement, you have a suicide attack on a French school.
Yes, I think that that shows very much that the threat towards the central government remains, and I think that that is precisely why the newly elected president, Ashraf Ghani, has been much more open towards the continuation of an American presence in the country than his predecessor, who bristled at every suggestion that the United States would maintain troops. And I think that that is also part of what's changed the debate and the conversation in Washington. Yes, as Michael was saying, you know, what happens abroad doesn't always necessarily impact what decisions are made in Washington. But when you have a president of a country who's much more open to your continuing your military presence, that means that the Pentagon then can have its way in a way, because there was a fierce debate between civilians and the military about what the U.S. should be doing in Afghanistan. But the Taliban will continue to mount attacks against targets in Afghanistan because the two worldviews are just irreconcilable.
By the way, the Pentagon is very pleased with Ghani, who last month approved the restoration of these night raids against suspected Taliban leaders and al-Qaeda figures. These night raids are very controversial in Afghanistan, where there's great revulsion at the idea of homes being invaded in the middle of the night. Of course, no one likes that, but in the Afghan culture particularly. So that is seen as a very important part of keeping the enemy on its back feet. The last thing I would say is that it's completely slipped my mind now. Anyway, we're very happy with President Ghani.
Good. You wanted to laugh.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, all of this is also, as we were saying, is taking place in the context of Iraq and the lessons being learned there from, you know, withdrawing all your troops and what it means for the local forces and their ability to stand up against renewed threats like ISIS in Iraq. And I think that for President Obama, this must be a very difficult moment.
Yes.
This was the president who wanted to withdraw from wars, who wanted to end wars. And suddenly he finds himself confronted with events. It's always about events, right?
You remember.
I remembered. I'm sorry. We talk about the savagery of ISIS, but I think we're a little numb to the Taliban and their mm-hmm. fiendishness. I just wanted to add, when you mentioned the suicide attack on the French school, sometime in the last day or two, the Taliban also sent a suicide bomber to attack a theatrical production condemning suicide bomb attacks. Just a kind of demented act and a window into the savagery of this group and the fact that I think they are on a level with ISIS or close to it.
Mark Landler, we have Guantanamo. Six men who were locked away for more than 12 years at Guantanamo spent Monday in seclusion at a military hospital in Uruguay's capital. Why did Uruguay take six prisoners from Guantanamo and then release them?
Well, it's actually a fascinating story that has to do with the president of Uruguay, Jose Mujica, who himself, as a young man, was a member of a guerrilla group and was imprisoned and treated horribly by the authorities in his country. So he has a legacy and a memory of this kind of treatment. And so he was, obviously sympathetic for personal reasons to the plight of these prisoners, none of whom were charged, as is common for people held in Guantanamo. He's now almost 80 years old, but he said, quote, "It's a very traumatic situation. I can't transmit how they must feel. Some of us have lived through similar things." President Obama spoke personally with President Mujica and obtained this agreement from him. You know, as you know, the difficulty for the president in his efforts to shut down Guantanamo is partly a difficulty in resettling the inmates. Most countries don't want them, and they can't come here because Congress has barred them being brought and settled in American prisons. So that's been one of the major log jams. This suggests maybe that we're seeing a break and we may see a slightly quicker pace of prisoners being transferred out.
How many are still there, do we know?
136 are still. 68 of those have been cleared for release.
Yeah, I see.
And the rest are a very hard population to deal with. And you talk to people who've worked on Guantanamo policy for a while, and they say these people are likely to be in legal limbo for a long time.
The interesting backstory to the Uruguay transfer is that this one was held up for quite a while by Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, who has to sign off on these transfers. And so long, in fact, that the National Security Advisor sent him a sharp memo asking him to pick up the pace. And some people in the administration say this was one of the contributing factors to the fallout between Hagel and the White House, which led to Hagel's resignation under pressure a couple of weeks
Interesting.
Ago.
Interesting. By the way, I do want to say the BBC is now reporting that UK airspace is in the process of returning to normal operations after their systems have been restored.
It's always good to quote the BBC.
Absolutely. Kim of the BBC. And Kim, let me ask you about what happened in Israel when a prominent Palestinian cabinet minister was killed. There was a clash with Israeli soldiers.
Yes, there was a clash between a number of protesters near the unauthorized Jewish outpost of Adey Ad. This was a group of people who wanted to plant olive tree saplings on a patch of land near a Jewish settlement. Palestinians believe that that patch of land has been earmarked for annexation by Israel. We're talking about the West Bank. And, you know, tempers have been rising in Israel and in the Palestinian territories. It's been a very bad summer for many reasons. Peace talks have broken down, if there were even peace talks to talk about. And this minister, Ziad Abu Ayn, 55-year-old, father of four, head of the PLO Commission Against the Separation Wall and Settlements, was leading popular resistance activities of Palestinians against the security barriers and settlements. He's there, he's talking to soldiers, border patrol, border guards, and there are tear gas being used. He is held by the throat at some point by one of the soldiers. He eventually collapses on the side and is declared dead soon after that. Now, the autopsy has been very divisive. The Palestinians say that he was killed in cold blood. The Israelis say that Mr. Abu Ayn had a weak heart and that he suffered from, or he succumbed from, the consequences of stress and the tear gas. Quite a tense situation adds to what has been just a slow unraveling of the situation in the region.
You know, one of the things that longtime Middle East peace negotiators often say is that even if peace talks are not seeming to go anywhere, merely having them is almost a release valve for tensions. And it's easier to keep a lid on these types of incitements and attacks and clashes. And if you look at the last few months, the collapse of the talks has, whether it was a direct cause or merely a contributing factor, led to this unraveling and poisoning of relations. And I think John Kerry, who's meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu in Rome this weekend, is likely to probably discuss these issues with him. That said, prospects for returning to the table seem further away than they have been for a long time at the moment.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And there was a report that a Palestinian poured acid on a group of Israelis in the West Bank this morning. What do we know about that?
Well, we know that there was a family traveling, I think it was between Jerusalem and Bethlehem. They were splashed with some kind of liquid, and they seem not to have been severely injured, but had kind of burning and choking symptoms that would be consistent with a substance like that. We'll hope that they are all right, but this is what can happen very quickly, of course, in this region, is you have these escalations, you have tit for tat. The Gaza war, that horrendous weeks-long conflict we saw this summer that created so much death and devastation, was the result of a kind of escalation, tit for tat, back and forth between the two sides. But an interesting thing kind of hanging over all this, Diane, is the fact that Prime Minister Netanyahu has dissolved his government, ousted a couple of cabinet ministers, and called for new elections in March. And a casual observer might say, well, with all this turmoil, the peace talks and the Gaza war and this terrible violence, Netanyahu is in trouble and people are saying, can't you keep us more secure? In fact, the prevailing issue in Israeli politics now has to do with taxes and housing prices and really the core of the political scrum there, at least in terms of this election and this political move that Netanyahu has made, has quite a lot to do with the budget and taxes, and security issues are somewhat secondary.
But is the Obama administration weighing sanctions against Israel, Mark?
Well, the State Department said absolutely unequivocally not, and I think I would take them at their word on this. Now, what I do think is significant is that mere fact that these kinds of reports are circulating in Israel attests to what has been a steady deterioration in the tone of the relationship between the Israeli government and the Obama administration, and particularly between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Obama.
What kinds of sanctions would you imagine?
Well, one could imagine curtailing or holding up military aid. That would be one of the most direct ones. The other thing the United States could do, and this has long been speculated, the U.S. could decide not to reflexively veto Palestinian moves at the United Nations. That's what the United Nations is typically a forum where the United States stands almost alone with Israel on certain things. They could decide not to do that. I haven't actually seen any indication there's truth to this, so I take it more as an example and a testimony to how bad the relationship is.
Mark Landler, The New York Times, Kim Katas of the BBC, Mark Crowley of Politico. Short break here. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Cy Sims Foundation. Since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a better life. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
On the next Fresh Air, two of the people just nominated for Golden Globes. We hear from Richard Linklater. His movie Boyhood is nominated for Best Film Drama, and he's nominated for Best Director. And we hear from Jill Soloway, the creator of the show Transparent, which is nominated for Best Comedy or Musical TV Series. Join us.
And welcome back. Time to open the phones. Let's go to Joseph. He's in Apopka, Florida. Hi there, Joseph. You're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Oh, thank you, Diane. Diane, I wanted to try and make a common thread that I see, which I think is valid, between the Senate report on torture and also the way prisoners were treated in Iraq, and also the betrayal, in my mind, of Snowden. The common thread that I think exists is the privatization of government responsibility. I think it's important for us to think more about the fact that the interrogation here in the States in this Senate report was turned over to two psychologists who were paid $80 million plus.
Yeah.
And they just created a company, as I understand it, in order to receive that money and proceed practically unhindered as they pleased. Also, in Iraq, the interrogation was done by private companies, and the generals and the military really were subordinate to them, my understanding. And then Snowden was contracted out under a private contract. I think there's a common thread here.
Common thread, Mark.
Well, I think the caller raises an extremely valid point and has zeroed in on something that is one of the most interesting details in the summary of the CIA report, which is the extent to which the U.S. relies on outside contractors for some of the most sensitive and questionable practices. And and even beyond the examples he cited, I can think of the security role played by Blackwater, the security role played in Afghanistan by Triple Canopy, and all these companies that became enormous, huge, you know, and very wealthy entities, and became self-perpetuating, and also gave the Pentagon or the CIA, whichever or the State Department for that matter, because these agencies all use these outside contractors, an extra layer of insulation sometimes from practices. So I do agree that in the aftermath of 9/11, we created this enormous national security state very quickly that relied on bringing in a lot of outsiders. And as part of this post 9/11 world that President Obama spends a lot of time trying to bring our country to, we really do need to have a thorough accounting of how we use these contractors and whether we should continue to, and in many cases we should stop.
All right, to David in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you're on the air.
Hey, Diane.
Hi.
Hey, Diane, thank you so much for what you do. We'd be a lot worse off if you weren't on the air.
Oh, thank you.
Really. But I just want to make a point that I honestly haven't heard anybody anywhere make, and all the discussion about the torture and the Senate Select Committee report. There's so much pushback from the right to try to justify even wrongdoing as a reaction to 9/11 or as a reaction to fighting groups like ISIS. The fact of the matter is, this stuff's been going on for decades. This didn't start with 9/11. I mean, I remember when I was in my 20s, the disclosure of the tiger cages on Khon Chaen Island in Vietnam, where we did terrible things to people, where we pushed political prisoners out of helicopters. And I won't even go into the more gory details of how we tortured people. This is nothing new. This wasn't something that just came about from 9/11.
Well, Diane, I guess I can't speak to American practices in World War II, Korea. I mean, certainly we know that in Vietnam there were, you know, there was the very famous My Lai massacre. Did we practice torture in those conflicts? I just don't know what the answer to that is. It's clear, however, that you know, unless there has been a very successful cover-up, it was not the policy of the U.S. government in the past, you know, 40 years or much longer. I don't know what happened in Vietnam, as I said, but to conduct these kinds of interrogations with these kinds of tactics, it was not U.S. policy, and that this was a clearly articulated new policy that emerged in the Bush administration after the 9/11 attacks. One problem is that some of the techniques went beyond even the articulated authorizations, which horrify many people. So I would say that the caller makes a factual claim that I can't speak to about, for instance, combat operations that the U.S. has had.
Sure.
But this really did involve a new sort of policy, which has now been banned.
A few quick points. Yes, you know, these abuses, practices have been used in the past. That's exactly the point that Dianne Feinstein was trying to make. We need to learn. We need to learn that it is not necessarily effective, that there are other ways of getting information. It goes to the point about how a nation reacts in the wake of an attack, and that document is perhaps now a way of reminding people of where not to go. And then finally, I think what is also a very important is the role of the CIA in trying to justify its action by using false information. The level of deceit by the intelligence agency to justify its continuation of using these techniques is also quite troubling. And I think that is a point that people need to focus on as well.
And I want to turn to the cyber attack on Sony that many are claiming may have been done by North Korea in response to a new comedy about an attempt to kill Kim Jong-un. The movie is titled The Interview, Kim.
Yes, The Interview, due to be released on Christmas Day in the U.S., featuring Seth Rogen and James Franco. They play two reporters who are granted an audience with the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un. The CIA then enlists the two to assassinate him. And in June of this year, North Korea said that this film was an act of war, an undisguised sponsoring of terrorism. However, they deny that they have anything to do with the hacking of the Sony emails. But the Sony emails do show how politics can get involved, even in the making of a film, because the request to change some of the parts of the film came from Kazuo Hirai, the chairman of Sony Corporation, Japanese, very worried about how this film could impact the relationship between Japan and North Korea, or add to the tensions in the region.
So how widespread was this hacking? How damaging was it, Mark?
Oh, extremely damaging and very well organized. I mean, the number of things that were disclosed of the Sony Corporation, not just the internal emails, but spreadsheets with all salary data, reasons for termination of employees and cutbacks, discussions of budgets for movies, and the trove of it is still being analyzed and looked at by people who continue to find details. You know, the FBI is not certain that the North Koreans are behind it, and there is some suspicion that that this could have required an insider, someone working on the inside, perhaps in cooperation with the North Koreans or others. But in the annals of this kind of corporate hacking, I think this is a landmark case. And I think, above all, it's a reminder to all of us who write emails to one another in a business setting to, I guess, assume that everything you write will someday be made public.
Open for reading.
Well, that's the point I was going to make, not even in a business setting. I worry that we are just entering an era of this kind of exposure. We all have essentially partial private diaries stored in the cloud somewhere, going back a decade or more. And I think we have to get used to a new reality where this is going to happen many more times before security catches up to it or deletion catches up to this reality.
My rule of thumb is don't write anything in an email you wouldn't say to someone in their face.
Or don't write anything you wouldn't want to see on the front page of the New York Times.
Yeah, that's right.
How's that?
Which was the old saying about government memos for senior government officials. It now applies to every single one of us.
Absolutely. Let's talk about Hong Kong and what's going on there, Mark.
Well, this Occupy Central movement that tied up much of central Hong Kong has finally and sort of unequivocally been disbanded.
The police
have shut down. They've removed the barricades, all the tents and other encampments that the students had built and maintained over 70-some days.
And why? What were they after?
Well, the students wanted something they ultimately didn't get. They wanted to have a change in a proposed electoral law that would have prevented China from getting something it wanted, which was the right to pre-screen anyone that runs for the post of chief executive. What that does, in effect, is make it clear that everyone has to be vetted by Beijing. The students didn't get any movement on it, either from the local government or from Beijing, from the Chinese government. And at one level, you could argue that the Chinese really are the victors in all this. They didn't have to roll tanks into the streets of Hong Kong. There were some ugly scenes early on when the police used tear gas and roughed up some of the protesters, but the ending of this protest was by and large peaceful. And in a sense, the government waited out the protesters.
Interesting.
All that said, I think that it's changed Hong Kong in important ways. I think it's given a political consciousness to young Hong Kong people that they never had. You know, I was a correspondent in Hong Kong in the late 90s, and the rap on Hong Kong has always been it's a place about commerce and materialism. It lacks a political consciousness. People really only want to make money and do their jobs. I think we've now seen vivid evidence that that's not true. Young Hong Kong people care deeply about their political future, and having been energized in this way, it's hard to imagine that they will now go back to that old stereotype of Hong Kong. And so I think for the Hong Kong government and for the Chinese, they're dealing with a different young population in this city than they've had in the past. And it'll be fascinating to watch whether this movement now mutates into a political party, into a more organized opposition.
All right, to Kevin in Virginia Beach. Hi there.
Hi, and thank you, Diane. I really appreciate the level of discourse that you and your panelists always have. So
thank you
for raising the bar.
Thank you.
Here's something that I'm interested in hearing you and your panelists discuss, and that is, what kind of reaction do we think is going to come from the Christian right with regard to torture? I can't find anything in the Bible that would suggest that Jesus or God would approve of torturing human beings to get information. And I'm curious as to what so-called religious conservatives are going to have to say about this. It seems that in the past, America has tried to take the lead on moral and ethical issues of torture and so forth. Now, polling looks a little different. So I'll take my answer off the air.
All right.
I really appreciate this discussion, and I hope to hear what the Christian conservatives have to say.
Thank you.
I don't think I have personally seen a response coming specifically from Christian conservatives, but I think that one doesn't need to be religious or believe in any religious book to look at some of these methods that were used and to come to the conclusion that it defies basic sense of humanity.
Humanity.
This is about humanity.
Absolutely.
I would certainly not want to justify any actions, but I can understand that on some level, people who are in these positions, who feel that they need to deliver for their country, feel somewhat justified in pushing people, bullying them to get some kind of information. I find it very hard to understand what happens to someone's moral compass when they start using the kinds of methods that are detailed in this report. I find it very hard to understand.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Steve, who's in Orlando, Florida. Hi there. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
Thank you. I appreciate your program very much.
Thank you.
Here's my question. My question is really for the future. What's the line that may not be crossed in the future? I'm talking about the Senate report on torture, of course. And let me give a specific example. So if physical methods of any type are off the table, what about psychological methods? Is it going to be acceptable or not acceptable, for example, to put a suspected terrorist in fear of his life without touching him? What happens 5 years from now when something like that comes up?
Well, Steve raises a very interesting point, and John Brennan, the director of the CIA, left this whole issue rather unresolved in his remarks at the CIA headquarters yesterday. He said that when asked sort of a variation of that question, said, well, that's up to the policymakers in the future. So, you know, it's not totally clear. And on the question of, you know, what might be in bounds or out of bounds, psychological torture actually was cited as one of the examples of the most egregious things that the CIA interrogators did. There was a case where the interrogator threatened to cut the throat of one of the suspect's mothers during the session. So while much of it was physical in the case of the CIA's methods, there were psychological dimensions to it as well. And so I think it's unresolved, and it's worthy of further discussion, because should there be something horrifying on the order of 9/11, it's very hard to guess what public opinion and the government's response is going to be.
And the debate gets murkier when you talk. There was a phrase we used to hear a lot kind of around the time of Abu Ghraib, torture light. And now some people may find that very phrase repugnant. But what it describes and what some people say we should be more open to is things like pushing people into walls or slapping them in the face, essentially harassing them. Maybe that's a too weak a word, but on a level that doesn't leave lasting harm, doesn't cause severe pain. You might confuse them. You might lie to them. I don't know about threatening to kill them. That would seem to me to be more than light, certainly. But there are gradations here. I think almost everyone hopefully basically everyone agrees that rectal feeding is out of bounds and horrifying and not something that we ought to do. But when you get into some of these other techniques, I think there's more debate about it.
I think that we're sort of coming back to the beginning of the discussion about what happens the next time that, God forbid, there is an attack against the United States, or that people feel compelled to seek revenge or, get information. As, you know, we heard from Michael Hayden and Dick Cheney, you know, the guys who were put in charge of getting this information were told, do whatever it takes to keep the country safe. And at the time, people supported that. There was probably some degree of support from the public, because perhaps they didn't know all the details. And I was reading this morning a story on NPR, actually, which raised a very interesting point about whether the depiction of torture on television and the depiction of it as being a successful method, has that numbed people to the idea that it's
Indeed.
Not acceptable?
Kim Kadas, State Department correspondent for the BBC, Mark Lantler of the New York Times, Michael Crowley of Politico. This has been a sad week for all of us. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Diane.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rain.